content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled The Calorie Countess by Michelle Stacy. A century ago, Dr. Lulu Hunt Peters introduced Americans to a revolutionary tool for losing weight. We're still living with the consequences. In 1909, more than a decade before the 19th Amendment would grant her the right to vote, Lulu Hunt Peters had already achieved a rare status for a woman of her time. She earned a Doctor of Medicine degree from the University of California when fewer than 5% of American medical students were female, and she was the first woman to intern at Los Angeles County General Hospital. She led its pathology lab for a time and later served as the chair of the Public Health Committee for the California Federation of Women's Clubs in Los Angeles. The role, wrote the Santa Cruz Evening News, came with more power than the entire city health office. She lectured frequently about public health and child nutrition. Over the next decade, though, what Peters came to regard as her greatest triumph was more personal than professional. As she entered her 40s, Peters used stringent and unrelenting discipline to slim what she described as her too solid body by dropping 70 pounds. That was what she really wanted to tell people about, with a fervency that approached the messianic. She began tailoring her lectures toward the Holy Grail she had discovered, a tool that she saw as the key to her weight loss, something called the calorie. Familiar territory even to school children today, the calorie was, more than a century ago, a niche concept just beginning to emerge from the laboratory and into public view. Peters was about to supercharge that evolution, in the process turning the meaning and use of the calorie on its head and spurring its transformation into one of the most enduring and significant health concepts of the modern day. The calorie gave the public its first penetrating view inside the foods they ate, providing an elementary understanding of nutrition. But it would also go on to torment millions, enrich corporations, inspire generations of advertising campaigns, provoke widespread guilt and pride, and even, some argue today, lead Americans fat gram by carb gram, calorie by calorie, into epidemic levels of obesity by instructing the masses to focus on calories rather than on nutrients and steering them toward highly processed carbohydrates. Peters ended up distilling her passion for calorie counting into a slim handbook, which was published in 1918 and went on to become the first diet bestseller in history. Titled Diet and Health with Key to the Calories, Peters' book did not stint on humor and playfulness. She engaged her 10-year-old nephew, the Little Rascal, to contribute whimsical stick figure illustrations, and she made up satirical names like Mrs. I'm a Gobbler, Mrs. Tiny Weigh a Ton, for hapless members of what she later in works would call the Friendly Fat Fraternity, epithets and terminology that would not go over benignly today. But throughout, she paid constant obeisance to the invisible and effable calorie. You should know and also use the word calorie as frequently or more frequently then you use the words foot, yard, quart, gallon, and so forth, she wrote. Hereafter, you are going to eat calories of food. Instead of saying one slice of bread or a piece of pie, you will say 100 calories of bread, 350 calories of pie. The idea had a novelty and simplicity that sparked a movement. By 1922, Diet and Health reached the bestseller list and remained there for 4 years, nestled among works by Mark Twain and Emily Post. And just like that, a century of calorie counting began, for better, or, as it's become increasingly clear, for worse. When Peter started proselytizing for the calorie in the mid-1910s, the concept was so new that the general public that she had to tell her readers how to pronounce the word, calorie, she explained, adding coyly that yes, calories are kosher. But researchers have been studying the calorie for decades, for reasons that could not have been more different than Peter's. The calorie, based on the Latin root calor, meaning heat, was first identified and used by the French chemist and physicist Nicolas Clément, who described it in the 1820s as a measure of heat that could be converted into energy. Specifically, it was defined as the quantity of heat needed to raise the temperature of 1 kilogram of water by 1 degree centigrade. Clément was not concerned with food or body weight, but with how to measure the steam energy needed to operate engines. In the decades that followed, though, other European scientists extended the idea to the human body, using the logic that the body is also a machine that burns fuel, food in place of coal, to create energy. By the late 1800s, German physiologists were measuring the energy values of food using Clément's methods and using a respiration calorimeter, an enclosed chamber that measures an animal's oxygen and carbon dioxide, as well as heat given off, to track how the energy was actually processed in the body. Beginning in 1869, and again in the 1880s, a New England chemist named Wilbur O. Atwater went to Germany to study the emerging science of nutrition. He returned with an idea that would revolutionize how Americans view food. The calorie, he believed, could help improve dietary health at the time, when malnutrition, not obesity, was the greater problem. And as a fitting addition to the ongoing Industrial Revolution, which was showing how science could transform daily life, the calorie could also make American workers ever more productive and at a low cost. The father of American nutrition science, as Atwater became known, wrote fervently in the 1890s about improving the intellectual and moral condition and progress of men and women by establishing a standardized formula for deriving calories from various foods, calling them physiological fuel values. This would allow Americans to choose their food by the numbers rather than by guesswork or emotion, and thereby get the biggest nutritional bang for their food buck. In our actual practice of eating, we are apt to be influenced too much by taste, he wrote. The solution was to regulate appetite by reason, aided by his lists of calories. His work has proved so durable that nutrition labels on every grocery store item today hark back to it. Calories are still based on the heat they generate, though scientists no longer subject food to a calorimeter, because their nutritional contents can be calculated by the Atwater system, which assigns a calorie value to each gram of protein, fat, and carbohydrate found in foods. In 1894, Atwater's nutritional guide became the first published by the United States Department of Agriculture. Hammering the economic point, it was filled with price calculations for various foods factored with the calories they provided. A section titled Cheap versus Dear Food compared the calories of energy available from, say, 25 cents worth of oysters with 25 cents worth of wheat flour. Newsflash, the flour was less dear. This little-known economic aspect of the calorie likely reached its apex in 1920, when former Michigan Governor Chase Osborne proposed that international trade should use the calorie rather than precious metals as a universal currency. The value of an item, he proposed, will be based on the calories required to produce it. For the example, the cost of a wool coat would depend on the calories needed to raise the sheep, shear the wool, sew the garment, transport it to the market, and so on. Unwieldy, to say the least. The progressive ideals of the age, which fixated on science, rationality, and quantification, were pervasive, and the nascent food marketing industry saw a possible bonanza. As early as 1915, the Joseph Schlitz Brewing Company seized up the calorie. Pure beer is next to milk as energy builder, Schlitz proclaimed in a newspaper ad, A glass of milk yields 184 calories. A similar glass of pure beer, 137, and doesn't make you bilious. An ad for Presto Quick Flour compared a pound of prime beef with a pound of its flour. 1,000 calories versus 1,600 calories, and their prospective prices. 25 cents versus 6 cents. Presto is thus proven four times as good value as beef. Just ponder on that. The excitement was also filtering into academia. When Peters was earning her medical degree, she likely would have studied Atwater's writings and his calorie guides as a tool in determining children's nutritional needs, one of her areas of expertise. Atwater died in 1907 while she was still in medical school. But her novel insight was to look at the calorie the other way around, by hypothesizing that it might be used not only to guide healthy weight gain, but weight loss as well. Peters was part of a movement of food reformers in this time period who were turning toward making food more rational, says Helen Zoe Vegt, a food historian at Michigan State University and the author of Modern Food, Moral Food, Self-Control Science and the Rise of Modern American Eating in the Early 20th Century. The idea was to eat, not because of tradition or, God forbid, for pleasure, but according to science and numbers and to the new knowledge about nutrition. Having struggled with what she felt was her own excess weight, Peters made her body her first research subject, and she interpreted her 70-pound loss as a resounding mandate. Peters was a savvy promoter, but she was also lucky. The decade in which she launched her calorie crusade was uniquely suited to her skills as a communicator and to her message. A tsunami of social transformations had been building from the turn of the century, including a shifting cultural preference from the curvy Gibson girl of the 1890s to a whittled-down boyish silhouette that would become the 1920s flapper. Through the second half of the 19th century, a certain plumpness, especially in women, had been seen as charming, healthy, and feminine. It also served as a signal of wealth and abundance. As the 20th century began, however, excess weight came to be associated with the lower classes and the poor, while slenderness became counterintuitively a sign of affluence and status. To explain the shift, many historians point to the ideas of American economist and social scientist Thorstein Veblen, presented in his 1899 book, The Theory of the Leisure Class. The new upper middle class that arose in the wake of the Industrial Revolution, he posited, displayed not only conspicuous consumption, but also conspicuous waste. And what said waste better than being food secure enough to turn away food? A starving person would never diet, but a debutante could if it meant slipping into a form-fitting ball gown. The shift is illustrated in a study of dieting among women at Smith College, published in the Journal of Women's History in 1995, which documented how body weight was seen between the 1890s and 1920s. In the earlier years, students wrote home about the wonderful feasts they enjoyed at school, and even about their goals to gain weight. A student weighing 135 pounds wrote to her mother in February 1892, "It is my ambition to weigh 150 pounds. Educators and social pontificators had fretted that academic life would take a toll on young women's health, and importantly, their feminine appeal and future reproductive capacity. Packing on a few pounds, rather than wasting away, was seen as proof of robustness." By the early 1920s, the script had flipped. Dieting culture became so pervasive that a letter to the editor, published in the Smith College Weekly in 1924, was titled, "To Diet or Not to Diet Yet," or "Not to Die Yet." Written by three Smith students, the letter warned against the obsession with weight loss. If preventative measures against strenuous dieting are not taken soon, Smith College will become notorious, not for the sylph-like forms, but for the haggard faces and dull, listless eyes of her students. Fashion followed a similar trajectory. 19th century designs had exaggerated female-specific roundness, first with hoop skirts and later with bustles. Although the generous bottom halves were balanced out by a nipped-in waist, courtesy of corsets. By the late Victorian era, doctors were railing against the garment, and what was coined the corset controversy arose. almost a century before the so-called bra-burning movement in the late 1960s. Early feminist Elizabeth Stuart Phelps Ward wrote in 1873, "Burn up the corsets. Make a bonfire of the cruel steel that has lorded it over the contents of the abdomen and thorax so many thoughtless years, and heave a sigh of relief. For your emancipation, I assure you, has from this moment begun. Fashion finally began to loosen its hold on the corset in the first decade of the 20th century, only to usher in the hobble skirt, a straight, narrow silhouette that replaced the nipped-in waist with a hem so tapered that the wearer's legs could barely move. Fashion designer Paul Poirot, the hobble skirt's inventor, wrote of this era in his 1931 autobiography. "It was in the name of liberty that I proclaimed the fall of the corset," while adding that though he freed the bust, I shackled the legs. The irony was that while women were giving up the torments of corsets and hobbles, they substituted a form of internal torture to control their bodies, what became known as reducing. To that end, they were aided by another innovation, the bathroom scale, when it appeared on the American market in 1913. Until then, people had their weight measured only at doctor's offices or at public penny slot scales found in movie theaters and department store restrooms. When medical advances like sanitation systems, vaccination, and pasteurization presented the promise of better hygiene and longer lifespans, people began to feel that their health was in their own hands. Personal scale, like the calorie, offered would-be reducers a magic number, a way to quantify their success or failure, and a sense of control over the process of reducing, or as Peters came to call it, Petersizing. Into this newly weight-conscious landscape stepped Peters. She began her book by being daringly honest about her frustrations with her weight, even as many other details of her life remained in shadow. We know that Peters was born to Thomas and Alice Hunt in 1873 and reared in the small town of Milford, Maine. She attended Eastern Maine State Normal School and then moved to California, where she married Lewis H. Peters in 1899. Several years later, she began her medical training. Lewis Peters plays nary a role in the history books, and he rarely appears in Lulu's writings. What did he make of her growing fame and of her hard-won smaller silhouette? Was part of her impetus to lose weight a desire to please her husband? On the contrary, in her book, Peters wrote that once you start reducing, you will have to combat your husband who tells you that he does not like thin women. "I almost hate my husband when I think how long he kept me under the delusion. Now, of course, I know all about his jealous disposition." She also mentions that she was near her heaviest when the two married, so presumably her plumpness was not a deal-breaker. Veit, the food historian, cautions against drawing conclusions about Peter's marriage. She does make sure to establish that she is married, because that would be a sign of status, Veit says. For a single, middle-aged woman, what was then called an old maid, to write a book like this would have been a mark against her, so she makes clear at the outset, "I have been successful on the marriage market." Other writers of weight loss narratives in the 1920s, who were enjoying their first boom thanks to both Peters and the new flapper ideal, were also explicit about slenderness being part of maintaining the chemistry in your marriage, Veit adds. At the time, attractiveness was being more and more linked to a certain kind of figure. In a presage of confessional media environment still far in the future, Peter's struggles with weight were part of her public persona, and as with Oprah Winfrey and Weight Watchers founder Jean Nydick, key to her business pitch. Of her pudgy childhood and relentless weight gain, she wrote, "I never will tell you how much I have weighed. I am so thoroughly ashamed of it." Only to add, "But my normal weight is 150 pounds, and at one time there were 70 more pounds of me than there is now." The use of the word ashamed to describe her 220 pounds was no accident. Peters believed that shame was a strong motivator, a notion that comes up repeatedly in her works. She later wrote a newspaper column titled, "A Disgrace to be Fat." Today, what we would call this language fat-shaming and recoil at the words, says Chin Ju, an interdisciplinary food historian at the University of Texas at San Antonio, and the author of Supersizing Urban America, how inner cities got fast food with government help. And yet, while we may not use such blunt language, Ju says, Peter's underlying fat phobia is still very much a part of dominant American ideas about what constitutes a healthy and aesthetically pleasing body. As for the word fat, she continues, today's self-described fat acceptance activists and advocates are trying to reclaim it by untangling it from ideas about morality and self-control. For Peters and others at the time, though, the supposed immorality of plumpness was intimately bound to her message. She compared keeping up dieting to keeping up other things in life that make it worth living, being neat, being kind, being tender, reading, studying, loving. Veit says, being fit was seen as the visible expression of moral issues, having to do with self-control, being smart, ambitious, efficient. All of these virtues from the era were tied up with not eating too much. Moreover, Veit goes on, she felt that she was speaking with authority. I've done it, so you can too. And that gave her license to be really outwardly, explicitly bigoted against fat people. Today, it's become socially unacceptable to say that fatness results from personal failings, but there remains a tremendous amount of moralization of thinness and fatness that's part of mainstream culture. Peters, ever the intuitive marketer, also linked what she saw as the inherent morality of slenderness to another high-profile virtue, patriotism. When the United States entered World War I in 1917, the federal government promoted cutting back on consumption with the catchphrase, "Food will win the war." Colorful cookbooks and posters extolled flourless victory meals and sowing the seeds of victory by growing your own vegetables. Every garden a munition plant. One leaflet explained the value of self-sacrifice more explicitly. Sugar means ships. The sugar used in sweet drinks must be brought to America in ships. These ships must now be used to carry soldiers to the front. Drink less sweetened beverage. We are at war. Every spoonful, every sip means less for a fighter. Peters put her own spin on the calories patriotism equation. Barely four paragraphs into Diet and Health, she wrote, in wartime, it is a crime to hoard food. Now, fat individuals have always been considered a joke, but you are a joke no longer. Instead of being looked upon with friendly tolerance and amusement, you are now viewed with distrust, suspicion, and even aversion. How dare you hoard fat when our nation needs it? You don't dare to any longer. Peters advised rounding up one's overweight friends and forming a Watch Your Weight anti-Kaiser class. The class should invest in an accurate scale, she explained, and meets once a week to weigh themselves, an idea, minus the Kaiser element, that found new life in the early 1960s, when Needick launched the neighborhood weight loss clubs that would become Weight Watchers. To her credit, Peters put her own boots on the ground in Europe after the armistice. In 1919, she joined a Red Cross medical delegation to the Balkans and stayed there for almost 2 years, earning decorations from the Serbian and Albanian governments for her child welfare and public health work amid the devastated post-war civilian population. Peters later wrote about medical calls on foot in the scorching sun over unkind cobblestones, long-distance calls on unkinder mules, longer hours in nerve-wracking clinics, and ferocious man-eating mosquitoes. She returned home in 1921 to find her book going into multiple editions, and on April 25, 1922, she debuted a daily diet and health column in the Los Angeles Times, which propelled the book to the bestseller lists. The column would ultimately be syndicated to newspapers nationwide and continue until her untimely death from pneumonia in 1930. From the start, Peter's column put her talents as a sprightly and engaging writer on display. She addressed the reader as a friend whose struggles she understood. She was also shrewd, in a surprisingly modern way, about the power of the come on and the cliffhanger. Titled, What's Your Weight?, that first column walked readers through the various ills, such as diabetes, that could be attributed to excess weight, before ending with, do you want to reduce? Foolish question number 13,579. Why? You want to reduce more than you want anything on the face of the globe or at the feet of the gods. We're going to show you how. Tomorrow's the day. And oh, it's oh so simple. Simplicity was the draw, in the same way that modern-day diets promise quote-unquote easy weight loss. What also likely kept readers coming, though, was Peter's frankness, her willingness to get into the trenches with other fat friends. One week into the column's run, she wrote an entry titled My Most Embarrassing Moment. In it, she described an incident when she was about 50 pounds overweight, and she stepped into an elevator. No one got out, and I got in, she wrote. The operator shut the door and pushed the lever of the car. No response. Back and forth he pushed. Car did not quiver. A gracious gentleman got out. The car didn't budge. Another gentleman followed to no avail. Blushing but game, I said with a wan smile that I would get out. The car shot up, but not fast enough for her to miss the imbecilic laughter of those inside. It was embarrassing, she admitted, but also invaluable. I reduced. Peters urged her readers to send in your most embarrassing moment, in the style of a modern-day master of social media soliciting likes and comments. And it worked. Eventually, she was receiving thousands of letters, which she often used as material in her columns. To Mary, who wrote Peters saying how much she was encouraged by her personal story of weight loss, she replied confessional length, "It's a continuous fight, Mary. I find that if I get started on candy nuts, I'm just like a drunkard with his dram. It was only last week that I had my last gorge. I had had a good dinner, but I had a longing for those pernicious candied nuts. I bought a pound, and I'll be darned if I didn't eat most of them myself. When I averaged my calories for the day, they amounted to nearly 4,000, almost enough to keep me going for 3 days. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian, so we will finish that article next week on our next program. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Pekepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.